It is an unfortunate truth that we use the term genocide a lot in today's world, and the term crimes against humanity only slightly less. While the practices themselves may be thousands of years old, the terms themselves are relatively young. And our guest today traces the origin of each term and their subtle differences, and the people who brought them forward, and why. Philippe Sands is the author of East West Street, on the origins of genocide and crimes against humanity. Philippe Sands is an international lawyer and professor of law at University College London. He lectures and teaches around the world and has been a frequent commentator on CNN and the BBC World Service. He's written some previous books, Lawless World and Torture Team. Philippe Sands, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, it's terrific to join you.
It's good to have you. Tell us what got your life pointed in the direction of international law and human rights and the realm in which you work.
Well, I'm a man in his mid-50s. I've spent the last 30 years working as an academic. I teach at the University of London, and I work as a barrister. And starting in the late 90s, I began to get involved in cases that involved crimes against humanity and genocide, the Pinochet case, when Senator Pinochet was arrested in London, the cases involving Yugoslavia, Congo, Rwanda, all the issues that we hear about, and then, of course, 9/11, Iraq, Afghanistan. And I increasingly got involved in that kind of work, and I focused on the origins of these two terms. Then, out of the blue, in 2010, I got an invitation to deliver a lecture on the work, on the cases that I'd done on the International Criminal Court, on all these kinds of things, from an obscure university in western Ukraine in a city called Lviv. Lviv used to be Lvov when it was part of Poland, and before that it was Lemberg when it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And I agreed to give the lecture, not because I particularly wanted to give a lecture on the subject, but because my grandfather was born in that city in 1904, and I wanted to see the city. And that opened a door that led me on the sort of detective story that is East West Street.
And I want to invite our listeners to take part in the detective story. If they want to go Google or check on a map, it's L-V-I-V. It's in Ukraine now. With all the changes in rulers over the years, how diverse a place was it in language and culture and ethnicity?
It was incredibly diverse. It was a very multicultural, cosmopolitan place by the 1920s. And essentially, there were three communities. And your question's a good one, because that is the heart of what happened and what caused developments that we're going to talk about this morning. Essentially, the three communities in pretty much equal parts were the Polish community, the Jewish community, and the Ukrainian community. And relations were generally pretty good, but occasionally there'd be sort of outbursts of tension of an ethnic or religious nature. And in November 1918, things came to a head immediately after the First World War ended. Remarkably, control of the city changed three times in the space of just 3 weeks. You know, one moment it was Austrian, then it was Ukrainian, then it was Polish. And that set of conflicts gave rise to killings and deaths and lots of mayhem. It was the moment when Poland emerged as an independent nation. The Treaty of Versailles was adopted, and people started thinking about the question, how can we use the law to prevent mass atrocity and mass killing?
I'm struck by the parallels to World War II in the sense that both wars, the actual shooting wars ended, there were treaties, et cetera, but then began the movements of refugees and the efforts to close borders, to declare that this is our territory now and not yours. It seems like that happens a lot after wars.
Absolutely. What we learn is that momentous changes in our value system and in our rules really only happen when great disasters have befallen us. And the book really focuses on that remarkable period between 1914 and 1946. It really begins with the opening day of the First World War and closes with the judgment at the Nuremberg Tribunal. And it traces the lives of four men. One of them is my grandfather, whose story, you know, he was a bit part player in the background, caught up in these great events of those 30 years, the terrible events of those 30 years. And I wanted to know what happened with him. But the three other men were much more significant in terms of public profile. One of them was Adolf Hitler's personal lawyer. His name was Hans Frank. And he became Governor General of Occupied Poland. And from November 45, he found himself in the dock at Nuremberg. And he found himself being prosecuted by two men from the city of Lviv. One was called Hirsch Lauterpacht. He was by then a professor at Cambridge University in England, but he'd been born in Lviv. And he is the man who created, in legal terms, the concept of crimes against humanity. The second man is Raphael Lemkin. He invented the word genocide, also in 1945, and he found himself on the American prosecution team. And remarkably, both men came from the same city. So that sort of caused me to ask the question, what on earth was going on in Lviv that caused the inventors of these two terms to originate from the same place?
Did you know that they had the Lviv connection before you went there in 2010?
No, it was sort of an amazing story, actually. I get this invitation in the spring of 2010, and I tell my mother, oh, I'm going to go up to Lviv. Do you want to come with me? I want to go and see what it's like. I want to see, you know, where my grandfather was born. And so I spend the summer doing research on the origins of crimes against humanity, and I'm pretty amazed to discover that the terms date to the involvement of these two men, and these two men come from the same city. So I turn up in Lviv in October 2010 to deliver the lecture, and of course begin by announcing that remarkably the origins of crimes against humanity and genocide as concepts may be traced not only to this city, I tell the audience, but to this very university that has invited me. And the people who had invited me had no idea. But it was one of those remarkable moments.
Well, it truly is a journey for you and a journey that you provide for us in the book East West Street. Philippe Sands is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is subtitled On the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. We'll hear more about the creators of the terms and what they did with their concepts as they moved into the Nuremberg trials when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your questions and comments in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest today is Philippe Sands. He is an international lawyer and law professor in London and the author of a book called East West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. And one of the things he discovered was that both of those terms came from men who at one time lived in the city of Lviv. You may know it as Lvov or Lemberg, depending on which period in history you're looking at. But a city that has changed hands many times is now in Ukraine. And led to these incredible concepts in how humans treat each other. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, stories, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So two of the men who created the terms, Hirsch Lauterpacht, who did Crimes Against Humanity, and whereas Raphael Lemkin, who came up with the term genocide, they both taught or worked at the University of Lviv.
Lauterpacht was there from 1915 to 1919, and Lemkin was there from 1921 to 26. They didn't overlap, and in fact, remarkably, I think they never seemed to have met. It's worth probably mentioning, crimes against humanity is concerned with the protection of individuals. Genocide is concerned with the protection of groups. And so one of the things I was curious about is why did the two men take different directions? Why did one focus on individuals? Why did one focus on groups? One of the, there were so many sort of exciting moments as you're involved in this detective story trying to uncover. One of the questions that you ask yourself is, who are their teachers? Who were the people who influenced them? And so I managed to find, it took a couple of years, I managed to find their student records dug up from some deep, gloomy basement in the center of the city, but remarkably they were intact, a bit moldy. But I found their student papers, I found the classes they took, I found the teachers they had. And basically I've managed to trace the single teacher who I think was the influence behind them, a man called Julius Makarewicz, a Polish professor of international law. He was actually a pretty ardent nationalist and not a strong believer in individual rights or human rights or the rights of groups. And both men seem to have been motivated as a sort of backlash against his teachings. And again, being forced, for example, to sit in the back of the classroom because they were Jews, or in the case of Lauterpacht, being actually banned from continuing his studies because he was Jewish. So that was the kind of environment that I think caused them to think about these issues.
interesting that, they were motivated by a professor, but not in a good way.
Well, I mean, it made me think, you know, I can imagine myself sort of wittering on in my classroom in London as I teach my wonderful students. And in fact, it's the very things that I think hope might influence them in a certain direction might have precisely the opposite effect. That is what seems to have happened.
All right, so we've established that the men both were at Lviv, both at the University of Lviv. What is the reference in the title, though, East-West Street?
Well, I think the reason the book has resonated, it's had really wonderful reviews. I've been very grateful for the New York Times and the London Times and the Wall Street Journal and others, is that it interweaves the personal and the sort of bigger public story. So East-West Street is a small street in a little town that is just outside Lviv. The town is called Żolkiew, Z-O-L-K-I-E-W in Polish days. Today it's called Żowkwa. It's a population of about 5,000. It's not very grand. It's not too impressive, one would say. But there's a single street that crosses East-West Street. And what I discovered was that Hirsch Lauterpacht, the man who invented the concept of crimes against humanity, and put it into international, was born on the western end of that street. And then I discovered, coming back to my grandfather, that his mother, my great-grandmother, was born on the eastern end, on the western end of East-West Street. So there was this sort of geographic connection between my family and the Lauterpacht family. And then if you fast forward 100 or more years after their birth and ask yourself, who was the teacher who was my greatest influence in doing what I do, who was the person who gave me my first teaching job at Cambridge University, it was the son of Hirsch Lauterpacht. His name was Eli Lauterpacht. Lauterpacht Hirsch only had one child, and he became my teacher in 1983. He hired me in 1984, got me my first teaching job, and we've worked together for over 30 years. But it was only in the last couple of years that we learned that we could trace our family origins to the very same street, and that is East-West Street.
Wow, it's a remarkably closed loop I had observed even before we got to this moment. We hadn't talked about your grandfather by name, Leon Buchholz. I mean, you knew him fairly well, but how much did he ever tell you of his life before 1945?
I did know him well because he lived until 97, so I was in my mid-30s when he died, and we spent a lot of time together. He lived in Paris. I knew he was a Frenchman. I'd known that he lived in Vienna in circumstances he'd never wanted to talk about and had left Vienna in circumstances he'd never wanted to talk about. And my mother had been born there in 1938, and she was too young to know by the time she left and was taken off to Paris. So I grew up in a family where I think for many people, and it's the same whether you talk about Rwanda or Congo or the Nazi Holocaust or whatever, people who've been through that tend not to want to talk about it. And so anything that happened before 1945 was a closed book. And what happened was when the invitation came in 2010, I said to my mother that I was going. She gave me a battered old suitcase, a couple of really battered old suitcases with a load of old documents in. I'd never seen them before, and I'd never seen contents. And inside were a few papers from my grandfather, and I started going through them. And because I'm a courtroom litigator, you know, I get a single piece of paper and I'm going to, you know, examine it to death until I can work out what it's really saying. You know, the amazing thing is every piece of paper, every photograph contains secrets. And the trick is to find out what is in them. And I came across two pieces of paper, one piece of paper and a photograph that I knew or I sensed contained clues as to what had happened. In terms of the family catastrophe that occurred in 1939.
And so what did happen to it? I mean, he got out of Vienna.
Well, I mean, on the family side, what I learned on my grandfather's side was that from the city of Lviv, there were 80 family members in 1939. By 1945, he was the only one left alive. So he had lost literally everybody. That I never knew. But more to the point, he was by then living in Vienna in 1939, and he got out. And I assumed he'd got out with my mother and my grandmother, but I learned that had not happened. They had left separately. My grandfather went first in January 39. He was followed on her own by my mother in July 39, but my mother was only a year old, so the question was, how did she get out? And my grandmother stayed behind. She stayed until the end of 1941, which was a big issue in my mother's family. Why had she chosen to stay behind? So the questions I needed to explore was, you know, who got my mother out and why did my grandmother stay behind? So it becomes a sort of personal detective story to understand what were the personal events that caused those things to happen.
And as long as we're on the subject, why don't we talk about Elsie Tilney? Because it's a name that is, it could be an afterthought in anybody else's book, but it ends up being a big afterthought in this one.
Well, Elsie Tilney is the lady, really, I think it's fair to say, who saved my mum's life, and who I have great reason to be grateful for. But for Elsie Tilney, I would not be speaking to you on the phone right now. Who's Elsie Tilney? Well, I didn't know anything about her. I find in my grandfather's papers a tiny scrap of paper, 1 inch by 2 inch, handwritten in pencil, old style, Miss E.M. Tilney, Norwich, Angleterre, which means England. And I say to my mother, who's this? And my mother says she doesn't know. So I spend 4 years tracking down Elsie Tilney. And I discover that she is a remarkable lady, an evangelical Christian missionary, born in 1893, who'd spent the early years of her life on mission in North Africa, bringing Jews and Muslims to Jesus, or trying to. I think she was not particularly successful. She passed through Paris in the late 30s. She must have met my grandfather. My grandfather asked her to go to Vienna and rescue his daughter, which she did. Elsie Tilney then spends 4 years interned in Vittel by the Germans and gets involved in various other adventures and lives out the rest of her life after she retires with her brother Fred, who is a bodybuilder and the man who discovered Charles Atlas, and they live. You literally couldn't invent this story. But most remarkably of all, when I've come to know the community called the Surrey Chapel in Norwich, who of which Elsie Tilney was a member, they're still very active. And we went into the archives to find out what had motivated her, and it turned out it was a sermon given by her pastor, David Panton, in which he had given a sermon about Paul's letter to the Romans, Chapter 10, verse 1, which they'd given a particular interpretation of. And on the basis of that interpretation, Elsie Tilney decided she would spend the war years saving people who were at threat from the Nazis. And so there's a sort of direct line between, you know, Paul's letter to the Romans, Elsie Tilney, Charles Atlas, Coconut Grove, and my mum and me. You couldn't invent it.
You really couldn't, but it's a wonderful story. It's a personal story interwoven with some huge earth-shaking sorts of things, the concepts of genocide and crimes against humanity. And the men who came up with those concepts, they are all characters in the book East West Street on the origins of genocide and crimes against humanity. Philippe Sands, the author, is our guest on The Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Jeffrey and Ashlyn gives us a chance to come back a little wider to the concepts of international law. And he asks of you, Philippe, your opinion on who has not been brought to trial and should be, and why.
Well, where do we begin?
Truly. I mean, you've written a couple of books about this already.
I have written a couple of books. One of the books focused on Iraq, which I'm afraid was an extremely unhappy story in 2003, and raises serious questions about the role of Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair. That was the subject of my first book. My second book then focused on what is called by some enhanced interrogation techniques, i.e. waterboarding, and which I call, and I think most people call, torture. And we have, of course, plenty of evidence that we had a clear statement from former President Bush that he authorized personally waterboarding. And waterboarding on a systematic scale is, I'm very sorry to say, a crime against humanity. And I think one of the real concerns that we have with the system of international criminal justice is that it's lopsided. You know, the weak tend to be caught up in the spider web of laws and the justice system, but the powerful somehow get away with it. So one might start with Messrs. Blair and Bush, I suspect, if we really wanted to get stuck in. But of course, right now, there are terrible atrocities going on around the world. One thinks of President Assad in Syria. One thinks of the appalling enslavement, torture, and rape of Yazidi women and girls. I'm rather involved in that right now. I wrote a long piece about it a couple of months ago in the Financial Times magazine. I mean, the list is longer than my arm, very sadly. But I think what I learn is that no one has a monopoly on atrocity, and no one has a monopoly on being a victim. These things go far and wide.
I wonder if you include drone warfare in that list.
That's a big issue right now in the UK. The UK has adopted a policy last summer of killing its own nationals, something that I know has been very controversial in the United States. I think a couple of US nationals were killed by drones, and there was a huge outcry in terms of the constitutional rights and bringing them to justice rather than killing them. Britain now has a sort of shoot-to-kill policy using drones, and there is now a debate going. I can see the logic of the argument that using drones is somehow surgical and clean. But I think the reality is what we've seen, as with all new weapons, as George Orwell wrote in a very famous essay, you think you've got the weapon, and then the other side gets the weapon, and then it seems less attractive. And I think it's only a matter of time before drones start being used against us. So I'm not a great fan of drones, I have to say.
So let's come to one of the major points of the book, which is the differences in the doctrines of crimes against humanity and genocide. You gave us a clue a while ago when you said crimes against humanity is really about individuals.
The debate between crimes against humanity and genocide is fundamental, basically, to all people. I've been in the U.S. this week doing book talks and speaking at various museums, and the penny drops when I explain that the difference really goes to who we are. Crimes against humanity is about protecting us as individuals, and genocide is about protecting the groups of which we happen to form a member. And that raises the fundamental question, who are we? Lauterpacht believed people were entitled to protection because of their inherent qualities as a human being. Lemkin answered, yes, that may well be very nice idealistic thinking, but the reality is people don't get killed because of their inherent human qualities. They get killed because they're a member of a group, and the group needs to be protected. Lauterpacht's concern was that by protecting the group, you reinforce the sense of group identity. You basically create a sense of them and us, and you give rise to the very conditions that the crime of genocide was intended to protect. In other words, you make the sense of group identity even more important. And Lauterpacht, who strongly opposed the concept of genocide, thought that the concept of genocide would replace the tyranny of states by the tyranny of groups. And I must say, from doing my own cases, I've seen that when you have to prove a crime of genocide, which requires you to prove an intent to destroy a group in whole or in part, it gets people very angry, very heated up, and they get very, very upset if they are only able to get a prosecution for crimes against humanity, which seems to them to be the lesser crime, rather than the crime of genocide. I can sort of illustrate it in another way. The great debate about whether what happened to the Armenians at the hands of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, in 1915, is that a crime against humanity or is it a genocide? The truth is, a million people died in terrible circumstances. And I ask the question, what does it matter whether we call it a crime against humanity or a genocide? It was wrong and it was terrible. And I think, the sort of fetishistic approach we have with labels is undermining the bigger issue, which is basically rooting out these terrible, terrible acts of killing.
Do the Turks deny that the Armenian genocide happened, or they just did not like the use of the term genocide?
They don't deny that a very large number of Armenians were killed. What they object to is that it is called a genocide. And the reason they object to that is that by calling it a genocide, it is elevated to being amongst the greatest of the crimes. I mean, you will have noticed, you read the newspaper, you will have noticed that if President Obama says that what's happening in northern Iraq right now in relation to the Christian communities or the Yazidis or the Shiites is a genocide, it will be on page one. If he says it's a crime against humanity, it'll be on page 13 if it's in the newspaper at all. And that's because for reasons that I think are very complex, psychological and political and other, the word genocide has come to be associated with the most terrible of crimes. And for the Turks, they don't want their acts of killing to be in that category.
Let's talk about the Nuremberg trials and the process of the Allies deciding to prosecute the leading Nazis and how Hirsch Lauterpacht ended up in the middle of it all.
Well, that brings us really to the fourth man. I would not have dealt with Nuremberg in the detail that I have. Both men became prosecutors, but for the fact that there was a fourth man in my book, and he occupies an equal space. We've talked about my grandfather, Leon Buchholz. We've talked about Lauterpacht and Lemkin. Let's talk about Hans Frank, Hitler's personal lawyer, governor general of occupied Poland, defendant number 7 at Nuremberg, prosecuted by Lauterpacht and Lemkin for the murder of 4 million Jews and Poles. on the territory of Poland between 1939 and 1944 and prosecuted for crimes against humanity and genocide. Why did I focus on Hans Frank? He is, rather like East West Street, the link between the three families. Frank arrives in Lviv in August 1942, fresh from the Wannsee Conference in Berlin, to announce the implementation of the final solution, the extermination of every Jew in the city of Lviv. And caught up in the mayhem and horror and killing that ensues in the 2 weeks after his visit are the deaths of my grandfather's whole family, Lauterpacht's whole family, and Lemkin's whole family. Fast forward to the Nuremberg trial, and we'll carry on the conversation about what happened then in a few minutes.
You take the music cue very well. Thank you for that. Philippe Sands is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is East West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. We'll talk more about the Nuremberg trials and what has emanated since that time in the way of international law and bringing people to justice. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Philippe Sands and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British international lawyer and law professor, Philippe Sands. He's the author of several books looking at the ways in which national organizations, well, nations, treat people. His latest book is called East West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. It's a fascinating story that all comes back to Lviv, a city in what is now Ukraine, where his grandfather once lived, as did the lawyers who created the terms genocide and crimes against humanity, and a Nazi officer who was prosecuted by the doctrines they developed at the Nuremberg trials. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So Hans Frank, Hitler's personal lawyer, ends up the governor general of the territory that includes Lviv and prosecuted at Nuremberg, correct?
Yeah, gives the most appalling speech, actually, again, by the sort of unhappy coincidence in the very room where I give my speech at the University of Lviv, announcing the mass murder of 125,000 people, which is what happens in the next 2 weeks. He doesn't put it in quite those terms, but that's effectively what he's saying and doing. He toddles off, spends the next 3 years getting up to his mischief, and then gets arrested in May 1945 by Lieutenant Walter Stein, a U.S. Army sergeant, and is carted off to imprisonment and the Nuremberg trial, where he sits in the dock. And many of your listeners will remember those famous dock photographs. He's always the one in the dark glasses. He's prosecuted by Lauterpacht and Lemkin. They have no idea about his connection with what happened in Lviv. They have no idea about the fate of their families. Right at the end of the trial, in the summer of 1946, they discover that the man they are prosecuting is the man directly responsible for the deaths of the murders of their own families. So pause for a moment and imagine how it must be to be a prosecutor to discover that the person you're prosecuting is responsible for the murder of your mother, your father, your brothers, your sisters. It must have been an extraordinarily poignant moment. And for me, what the book does, I hope you're picking up, this is not a dry, turgid legal tome, more like a detective thriller. It's the points of detail that I really am motivated by. And one of the things that I discover is that in that summer, July 46, Lauterpacht writes to his son, Eli, who was my teacher many years later, tells him, I've just learned that the entire family has perished. I'm preparing the closing arguments for the British prosecutors. And the only thing that helps me get through the day is to listen to the music of Johann Sebastian Bach and the Matthew Passion. And remarkably, that very same moment, Hans Frank, who's on the opposite side of the courtroom in the dock, staring at the prosecutor's desk at which Lauterpacht sits, tells the U.S. Army psychologist in the trial, the marvelous Dr. Gustav Gilbert, who wrote a fantastic diary about treating the 22 defendants, tells Dr. Gilbert, Frank tells Dr. Gilbert, the only thing that gets me through the trauma of being in this trial is to imagine that I'm listening to music, and in particular, to imagine that I'm listening to the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, and in particular, the Matthew Passion. So it gets the imagination going, two men sharing the same musical space, but on opposite sides of the courtroom at that same moment in July 46. It really makes you think, you know, the power of music and the ideology of music and what's actually going on there.
Oh, truly. But so many other things that you think about, too, in the parallels and yet the ways in which things are not, people are not similar. Lauterpacht had a constructive relationship, you point out, with the American Robert Jackson. Tell us about who he was and how they came to work together.
Jackson spans the lives of all of these men. He prosecuted Hans Frank, he worked with Lauterpacht, and he hired Lemkin. So Jackson is at the epicenter of the story. He was the former attorney general for President Roosevelt. He then became a Supreme Court justice. If you like coincidences, and you seem to, judging by your questions, you can imagine I was pretty stunned when I learned that my agent, my literary agent in New York, with whom I'd worked for many years, Melanie Jackson, is, yes, you guessed it, the granddaughter of Robert Jackson.
Wow.
I literally had no idea. And she was kept very silent about it when I sent her the first draft of the book to find a publisher. And we ended up with the wonderful Knopf and Vicky Wilson. About a year into the project, she said, actually, this book's really interesting for me because two people very important to me are in this story. And I said, oh, yeah, who's that? And she said, well, actually, my grandfather and my father. Robert Jackson is obviously very well known, but Robert Jackson's assistant throughout the entire trial was one Bill Jackson. And Bill Jackson is Melanie Jackson's dad. So, you know, I don't know how one explains these coincidences and, you know, what is it? What is it that causes these things to come together? But Jackson is a central player. Jackson, he doesn't have such a great trial. He cross-examines Göring, and it collapses. Göring runs rings around him, which is the subject of a pretty vicious article in New Yorker magazine by the wonderful Janet Flanner. And the Brits have to pick up the pieces. And interestingly also, coming back to the main point of our discussion, the word genocide never once crosses the lips of Robert Jackson in the courtroom. No American prosecutor supports the charge of genocide. And you might ask, and I'm sure you're thinking, why would that be? And the answer to that seems to be that Jackson came under intense pressure from southern U.S. senators not to use the word genocide, to oppose the concept of genocide, because of a concern that it would be used by blacks in the United States in relation to their treatment in the 19th and well, large parts of the 20th century.
All right, and this gets us right back into Lemkin's zone because he actually spent a fair amount of time in the American South during the war. So,
indeed.
You mentioned that he took note of Jim Crow facilities where you had separate drinking fountains and restrooms. What did he make of that?
It's great to have this conversation with you. You've obviously picked up the points of detail. I was just astonished when I got into his documents and memoirs. He has this incredible journey when he escapes from Poland in 1939. He makes his way to safety in Sweden. He teaches in Sweden for a year, and then he gets this invitation to teach at Duke University in North Carolina. And he travels all the way across the world. He can't go the quick route, the Western route, because the Atlantic is up. And so he has to go across the Soviet Union and across the Pacific Ocean, ends up in Seattle, and then takes a train all the way across to Chicago. In Chicago, he then takes a train south to North Carolina, and the train stops somewhere, and he gets off for a pee stop. And he's astonished to see that one of the toilets has a sign with an arrow which points one way for white people and one way for black people. And he inquires what on earth is going on, because he's never come across such a thing before. And it's pretty appalled, but in a bemused sort of way. He never talks about this when writing about the concept of genocide. I think he was sort of politically acute and politically sensitive, but it was plainly part of his consciousness. He was well aware of what was happening in the southern states, and he was well aware of why he failed to persuade Jackson to really go for the genocide charge. And in fact, at the end of the day, the judgment comes down in October 1946, and the word genocide does not appear anywhere in the judgment, although the Soviets, the French, and the Brits have all pushed for the prosecution, for the conviction of Frank, for genocide. Because the Americans failed to do so, the judges went with the Americans, and Frank was convicted of crimes against humanity, but not genocide.
You give us an idea of how careful a thinker and writer Lemkin was, and it sounds like there were quite a few discards before he got to the term genocide.
Well, he started, so he goes to law school, 1921 to 1926. He then becomes a public prosecutor and gets involved in the work of the League of Nations, which, preceded the United Nations. And he gets involved in international criminal law work and comes up with this idea in 1933 that something needs to be done to protect groups. And he originally calls the crime that became genocide, two different crimes, the crimes of barbarity and vandalism. And he writes a paper which he is to deliver at the League of Nations conference in Madrid. And one of the things that I rather like about Raphael Lemkin is that he's prone to embellishment and prone to telling little porky pies, as we call them in the East End of London. You can work out what the rhyme means for yourself, and your listeners can too. My favorite one, porky pie is a lie. But it's a little lie. It's a gentle one. So I discover in the archives in North Carolina, the speech that he gives when he arrives in North Carolina, announcing how in 1933 he went to Madrid, he delivered the speech on barbarity and vandalism and precursors to genocide. And the speech was so powerful that two heads of the German delegation stood up and walked out of the room in protest at what he was saying. The problem with the story is that he wasn't there. He did not attend the meeting as he was intended to attend, because the Polish government, in the light of the election of or the coming to power of Adolf Hitler, decided it would be too provocative to send him down to Madrid. So we know that the paper was distributed. We know that the two people he claimed to have left the room attended the conference. But I also know that he wasn't actually there. So it's a kind of little story that sheds a little light on his character, and not in a bad way, I think. In which the truth is essentially, as he puts it, but the embellishments allow you to imagine his desire to take the story a little further than it might go.
Mm-hmm. We have, not surprisingly, a few questions from listeners about genocide and international law. Jenny in Roseburg writes, do you have any view on the role of psychopathy in human rights violations worldwide? With a certain percentage of the human population having psychopathy, I've had a thought there are times in society we're able to contain those people and those traits within the rule of law, and at times such individuals come to power and psychopathy becomes the governing principle, even though it only takes a very small number of psychopathic individuals to drive or normalize the violence. Examples, of course, Rwanda or ISIS, but also thinking of the tide of mafia violence and violence in Mexico.
Yeah, I've thought about this question a lot. It's another terrific question. I don't believe in the inherent evil of any particular individual. I think that people come into the world and they are influenced. And I illustrate that. I mean, I don't talk about psychopathy in the book in those terms, but I illustrate the book to explain why did Hans Frank do what he did. Let me give you an example. I discovered correspondence between Frank and his wife, Brigitte. And in that correspondence, it becomes very clear what happened in the summer of 1942. Frank's childhood sweetheart, Lily, comes back into his life. She's looking for her son who has disappeared on the Eastern Front. She writes to Frank and says, can you help? Can you go and find him? Frank uses the opportunity to get back in touch with her. They meet up in Munich, and a raging and flaming affair begins between the two of them. And Frank decides he's got to get a divorce from his wife, Brigitte. It's time to divorce. It's July 1942. The Wannsee Conference, where the final solution at which he was involved, has just passed. And so what does he do? He tells his wife that he wants a divorce. And the reason he wants a divorce is he's about to get involved in things that are so terrible and so criminal that it would be better for her if she distanced herself from him. In other words, he's using the final solution to get a divorce. Now, is that psychopathic behavior? I don't think it is. I think it's a man who is essentially weak, who has a particular urge and a desire in relation to one woman, who will stop at nothing to implement that desire, and he'll use the arguments that he can. It's, for me, it's weakness rather than psych- psychopathic behavior. But different people will have different views about it. And Hans Frank's son, Nicholas, who I've come to know, we made a film together called My Nazi Legacy, which actually has just been bought by Netflix, and your viewers can watch on Netflix right now. It's available.
My Nazi Legacy, okay, yeah. And you actually went to the courtroom together with Nicholas, didn't you?
We did. We went together. You can see it in the film, and I write about it in the book. Nicholas Frank wrote a vicious attack on his father. But Nicholas Frank does not believe that his father was a psychopath. He believes he was a weak, useless, terrible man, a criminal who, as Nicholas says to me memorably, and I put it in the book, Nicholas says to me, I'm against the death penalty, except in the case of my father, which is a sort of pretty tough line. Nick's view is, no, he wasn't a psychopath. He was just a weak, weak man.
You write of the failure of good intentions that were aired in the Nuremberg trials. How did they fail?
Well, I think, you know, if you want to see a great moment of the Nuremberg trial, go onto YouTube and watch the clip, it's just 3 or 4 minutes, of Robert Jackson's opening speech of the Nuremberg trial. If you just, you know, type onto Google, you know, Nuremberg Jackson opening, you'll get it. And you hear these remarkable, powerful words, beautifully delivered. Never again. In the name of the victorious powers, we will now move to ensure that laws and crimes are put in place to make sure this never happens again. Sadly, as I know from my daily work, you know, I gave you the litany of horrors that I've been involved in, Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Chile, Argentina, Bosnia. I mean, the list just goes on and on. We know that these things have not, sadly, come to an end. And rather like domestic laws, murder continues and mass murder.
It's an amazing book, compelling on so many levels. The book is East West Street, On the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. Philippe Sands is the international lawyer who wrote it, and he's been our guest on The Exchange today. Philippe, thank you so much.
Terrific to join you.
All right, take care.